PhD at MIT in 95, then spent 2 years in Bell Labs, postdoc, and was an assistant professor at Pennsylvania State University, and then Ohio State University, and finally in 2001, he joined the University of Toronto and became a professor at, in 2006. Today he will tell us, he will answer a question, where are we in liquid research? Please start.
So, thank you very much to organizers for inviting me to Perimeter Institute. Actually, this is the first time I can now see the new wing. It's really beautiful, right? But then I realized that in order to navigate this building, you need a very high intelligence. So I guess this building is made for only for very intelligent people. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about today is sort of overview of the spin liquid research. And in particular, I'll be focusing on what we call quantum spin liquid. And I will try to sort of give you some ideas as to what we really mean by that. So what I'm trying to achieve today is something like this, spin liquid for dummies. But so what that means is that I'm going to stick to the basics. So some of the experts in the audience may not find any really new information about this. Maybe there's some relation to topological quantum computing. So here is the outline. So I'm going to sort of give you sort of rough definition of quantum spin liquid. And then I like to go over some of the recent experiments that indicate that, you know, we actually do have some candidate materials for this kind of phases. Then I like to give you some brief stories about, you know, what kind of theories we have. And based on these theoretical ideas, I like to give you some interpretation of those experiments. And if I have time, then I like to talk about some more exotic version of spin liquid that we call topological Mott insulator. So hopefully I will have time for that. Okay. So in order to explain what we mean by quantum spin liquid, I like to start with the discussions, you know, about like what we don't mean by that. Yeah. So because there's some confusion in the literature. So I would say this is different from what we call cooperative paramagnet. So we understand that if you put, say, spins on a frustrated geometrical first lattices, then even at the classical level, you can have, say, a large number of equally unhappy degenerate classical ground state. And typically, number of such degenerate classical ground state scales exponentially with the number of spins. So you end up with exponentially large number of degenerate classical manifold. So this is the typical behavior of such frustrated magnet. So if you measure inverse susceptibility as a function of temperature, then at high temperature, you see usual Curie-Weiss behavior. So general expectation is that chi, you know, susceptibility, magnetic susceptibility goes like 1 over temperature minus Curie-Weiss temperature. So Curie-Weiss temperature is some kind of mean field ordering temperature. So it's based on the local physics. So it is expected at some mean field level that your magnet is supposed to order at Curie-Weiss temperature. And this is supposed to be valid if the temperature is much, much bigger than Curie-Weiss temperature. And in many frustrated magnets, because of this macroscopic degeneracy, the magnet doesn't order down to very low temperature. So well below Curie-Weiss temperature, you don't see any magnetic ordering. So that's the, you know, so we, if you take the ratio of this parameter, where I'm taking the ratio of Curie-Weiss temperature, that's like a mean field ordering temperature of your magnet, and TF is the temperature where something actually happens, like you can have a magnetic. Eventually, you may have a magnetic ordering there, or you may have some other spin glass-like behavior, things like that. So obviously, if this parameter is very, very big, then your frustration is big, right? So, for example, if you don't see any magnetic ordering down to zero temperature, your frustration parameter will be infinity. But you know, usually we don't measure this thing down to zero temperature, so we don't know what the real F is. But typically in frustrated magnet, you get a large F. So point is that usually there are large window or in the temperature regime, there's a large window between like Curie-Weiss temperature and the temperature where some action eventually happens. And this phase is called cooperate paramagnet. And this is what people call classical spillikin. So in this phase diagram, for example, there's really no quantum physics. It's really all about degenerate classical manifold. This is not what we mean by quantum spillikin. Okay. So this is also different from a boring incoherent high temperature paramagnet. So where, you know, there's a thermal fluctuation, so each spin just fluctuates independently from each other. And they don't talk to each other, so there's no coherent excitation. So this is a boring high-temperature paramagnet. This is not, obviously, the kind of spin-liquid phase we are talking about. So what is spin-liquid? So there's a very good example in one dimension. So if you take a spin-half Hasselmann model in one dimension, we know that the ground state is spin-liquid. It's a quantum paramagnet, then there is no translation symmetric breaking. But we do understand that the coherent excitations in this quantum ground state is a spin-half spin-on. So namely, it's a particle that carries only spin quantum number, but no charge quantum number. So how do you prove that such a particle actually exists? So there have been a lot of experiments on quasi one-dimensional spin chain model. So the one way to do this is to do a neutron scattering experiment. So if you remember how neutron scattering is done, basically neutron scattering probes the spin one excitation because basically you're probing the spin flip. So because you're probing a spin flip, you're measuring a spin one excitation. Now remember that those spin ones only carry spin half quantum numbers. So in order to create a spin one excitation, you basically have to create spin one anti-spin one pair. Yeah? So you're creating an spin one anti-spin one pair excitation. And these spin-on anti-spin-on pair excitations carry a well-defined dispersion because each spin-on is supposed to have a well-defined dispersion. So by taking some combination of, you know, spin-on and anti-spin-on combination, you can easily calculate sort of the bottom of the dispersion of the two particle continuum, the spin-on anti-spin-on pair continuum. So typically, if you measure, say, neutron scattering cross-section or a structure factor, then this is the area in omega q plane where you see a coherent excitation, and this is the bottom of the band, or bottom of the continuum. And this bottom of the continuum is basically determined by some combination of spin-on dispersion. So that way, you can indirectly measure coherent spin-on excitation. And this kind of experiment is done on a quasi one-dimensional spin chain. And this experimental proof that in 1D, you can indeed have a spin-liquid. The real question is, can we have something like this in higher dimensions? So that's basically the question. So there are generally two kinds of quantum paramagnet at t equals zero one can think about. So one of them is this famous valence bond solid that breaks translation symmetry. So this symbol represents the single bond between two spins at nearby site. But then if you don't break translation symmetry, and if you have, say, odd number of spins per site, then another interesting possibility is indeed this higher dimensional version of the spin liquid. Elementary excitation in such a phase is indeed charge neutral spin half excitations. You may or may not have a spin, you may or may not have a spin gap. So one way to think about spin liquid is to think about a so-called resonating valence bond state. So what you do is as follows. So you think about a valence bond configuration for a given lattice. So you can think about all kinds of possible valence bond covering of the lattice. Then you do a superposition of those. So if you do so, then obviously such a superposed state does not break any translation symmetry. And so that's a possible candidate state. And typically, there are two kinds. You can sort of think about two kinds of valence bond solid state. So there are resonating valence bond state we call short-range RVV. So what actually happens is that the size of the, say, valence bond or dimers are sort of short-range. And in this case, obviously, there is a well-defined length scale in my problem. So because of that, typically what happens is that your spinons are gapped. There's a finite spin gap. And spin-spin correlator usually decays exponentially. Remember that in this case, there is a length scale associated with the spin-spin correlation. But on the other hand, you can also think about what we call long-range radiolarian valence bond state. So in this case, basically the valence bond formation can happen between two spins that are arbitrarily far away. So think about a superposition of valence bond covering, where basically you also have to include the valence bond that are, you know, that extends over many, many lattice spacing. So since I'm talking about superposition of those, obviously in that case, there's no length scale in my problem. So the only spin-spin correlation I can possibly have in such a state, some kind of algebraic correlation. Yeah? So this is what happens in the long-range RVV state. So your spin-spin correlator decays algebraically. And sometimes, because of this, sometimes this is called critical spin liquid. And then you can talk about spin-on excitations that's actually gapless. The spin gap is basically zero. So roughly speaking, you can classify spin liquid phases like that.
So on this first one, the dimer-dimer correlation is not, no, it is algebraic in this, in like even the short range RPG, right?
So doesn't that mix up that picture somehow? So like the dimer-dimers typically go as one over R to the 1 point something. The dimer-dimer correlation functions.
So
algebraic. It's only the spin.
Right, but as far as your spinons are gapped, you will always get this exponential decay correlation. So there are situations where spinons are actually gapless, but nonetheless, you can have such a picture in the valence bond. So in this kind of short-range valence bond picture. So in that case, you can, in principle, have algebraic decay correlation with this kind of picture. But in any case, if spinos are gapless, then you should get a, yeah. If spinos are gapped, then you should get a exponentially decaying spin-spin correlator. So those cases exist, but those cases are actually rare examples. Okay. So there are a number of candidate materials for quantum spin liquid. And obviously, you want to look at the most quantum mechanical system. So obvious choices will be spin-half system rather than higher spin system. So for example, there are two famous examples of organic materials. And they actually, you know, it consists of organic molecules, but effectively what happens is that there are spin half degree of freedom sitting at triangular lattice, or anisotropic triangular lattice, so hopping along this axis, this link and that link. This link and that link is not exactly the same. So it's an anisotropic model. So there are two kinds of organic material like that. And then there are inorganic materials. These names like, you know, Herbert-Smithite, Goldberg-Smithite, Bissignite, all these names came from geophysics, basically. So these are all minerals that exist in nature. So it was mostly discovered by geophysics people. But then people discovered that these materials has this some kind of distorted version of the Gagomel lattice. Okay. And in particular, for Herbert-Smithite's case, it's supposed to have a more ideal Gagomel lattice structure. On the other hand, for these two materials, we understand that it's a distorted version of the Gagomel lattice. But nonetheless, many of these materials actually show basically no magnetic ordering down to very, very low temperature. So these are all sort of two-dimensional examples of quantum, you know, possible spin liquid state. But then there is a three-dimensional version of it. So far, we only know one example, one possible example of quantum spin liquid. This is called the hyper-Gagomel lattice. So what actually happens is that remember that the Gagomel lattice is basically corner-shading triangular structure in two dimensions. And you can sort of have that kind of structure in three-dimensional system. So it's a three-dimensional version of the Gagomel lattice. It's a corner-shading triangles, but the structure is inherently three-dimensional. And so in many of these systems, basically, this is typically what you see. So again, if you measure inverse spin susceptibility as a function of temperature, you see this Q device-like behavior way below Q device temperature. The heat capacity shows something like power law in temperature kind of behavior. So notice that these are all charge insulators. So charge degree of freedom is basically gapped out. But nonetheless, you have a constant susceptibility at low temperature, and your heat capacity is, has shown some kind of power law behavior. So it means that you have a lot of low energy excitations in your system. You know, power law heat capacity tells you that basically these excitations are not gapped out. It has to be a charge neutral excitation because your charge gap is finite. And they must carry spin quantum number because you get a finite susceptibility, spin susceptibility. So combining all these facts, one promising candidate for the ground state is obviously a spin liquid state, where if the spin carrying excitations are gapless, then those excitations can give you both constant susceptibility and power law heat capacity. So this is sort of the general idea behind all this business, you know, like identifying ground state of those materials as the quantum spin liquid state. Is it clear? Okay. So I'm going to show you some representative data of this material. So this is again, you know, I'm plotting 1/chi. In this case, this is the susceptibility as a function of temperature. And you see that even though a Q-device temperature is quite big.
Are you going to make a comment about the difference between Matabar systems and?
Yeah, I will. Okay. Yes. So even though Q-device temperature is quite big, basically you don't see any magnetic ordering in the spin susceptibility down to very low temperature. Again, if you look at the heat capacity, many of them indeed show power law in temperature kind of behavior. So in all of these materials. Okay. And also, you can measure sort of low energy spin excitations by doing a NMR experiment, nuclear magnetic resonance experiment. So that basically measures the density of excitation around the particular magnetic moment. And it's a relaxation rate of some local spin moment that basically couples to, you know, a lot of spin excitation nearby. And basically, if 1/T1 is a relaxation rate, if 1/T1 multiplied by 1/temperature is constant, it means that you get a finite density of spin excitations. And in many of these materials, it also shows that. So not just susceptibility, also NMR data is consistent. There are more recent examples of quantum spin liquid phases. And so this is, it's an inorganic version of the triangular lattice. Remember that before the triangular lattice example were all organic material. And this is an inorganic version of a triangular lattice. Here, the spin is half. It's basically kappa 2 plus gives you spin half moments on the triangular lattice. In fact, this system is should be described as a stacked triangular lattice with AB stacking. The Q-device temperature is supposed to be like 55 Kelvin, but down to very low temperature, they don't show magnetic ordering. And again, heat capacity gives you sort of almost T-linear behavior. In temperature, its susceptibility may be constant at very low temperature. And what's interesting about this series of material is that it's now spin 1 version of it. Spin 1 is, in principle, slightly less quantum mechanical. But nonetheless, similar behavior is seen. Here you have to see this curve, and susceptibility is almost constant. And for the same material, the heat capacity is sort of linear in temperature. So again, it shows the power law in heat capacity and constant susceptibility. So they all share sort of similar kind of characteristics. Okay, so here's a summary of this material. Basically, you know, the two organic material based on triangular lattice. And there are a couple of Gagomel lattices, then also a three-dimensional hyper-Gagomel lattices. The frustration parameter is very, very big. So all of this material may be a good candidate.
So the previous example, this is the heat that you were showing.
Yeah.
What's the low temperature y intercept?
So the gamma is like this. For example, for the spin
yeah,
material.
Yeah, I just want to know if they shifted the specific heat.
You mean this one?
Yeah. So I mean, it's linear, but is it AT or is it B plus AT?
It's AT. Yeah, it's AT. It's a logarithmic plot, so it's difficult to see. But it's AT. There's no.
Yep.
But you see, in this business, you have to do lots of subtraction. There are, you know, contributions from local impurity and things like that. So even though, you know, basically I have to say this is a massage data. And also, they knew what they wanted to get. So you know, you have to take this with a grain of salt, right? Because there were lots of examples before, so with this, you know, they sort of knew what they'd be interested in. So I'm, yeah. But, you know, sort of with reasonable subsection scheme, you can get this magnetic contribution to the heat capacity. So it's not trivial. It's not trivial. Okay, so we now understand that this material can be classified into two kinds of systems. So, for example, these two materials are actually very good insulators. Charge gap is really big. These are extremely good charge insulators. On the other hand, these materials are not. For these materials are actually very close to a metal insulator transition. So these are very weak mal insulators. And it makes a difference in terms of physics. For example, so let me explain that. For example, by applying say moderate pressure, you can make the charge gap to zero, meaning that you can basically drive a transition from mal insulator to a metallic state. So you can do that with this organic material, you know, triangle lattice. Then this is the resistivity data of three-dimensional hypergargamel lattice. I'm applying a pressure, then you see that by applying, say, this amount of, like, 7 gigapascal, you can change the resistivity by 6 orders of magnitude. So it's a huge change. Yeah. So it must be the case that both materials are very, very close to a metal insulator transition. And this makes the story actually more interesting, because basically, if your system is very close to a metal insulator transition, and then this is typically what's going to happen. So in the large U limit, when the charge gap is very, very big, we understand that if I start from a Hubbard model, the effective model is just a spin model, the Heisenberg model, by doing a second order perturbation theory. Now I'm going into a metal insulator transition point, then my charge gap is becoming smaller and smaller, and there are lots of virtual charge excitation, and that basically mediates longer and longer range spin exchange interactions. So you generate all sorts of longer range spin exchange terms. So charge fluctuations are actually very important near the Mott transition, even though you are in the insulating side. And this way you can generate a longer range exchange interaction. So it opens up an interesting possibility like this. So for example, on the triangular lattice, the very large limit, we understand what the ground state of Heisenberg model is on the triangular lattice. It has to be a 120 degree order. We know that. So you may get an antiferromagnet in the very large limit, but there is a possibility that you may get a sort of a charge fluctuation induced frustration near the Mott transition. So if you don't take into account this charge fluctuation in this long range exchange interaction, then you may expect that there should be a transition from metal to antiferromagnet insulator. But in the middle, you know, because of this frustration, you may actually be able to stabilize a spin liquid insulator. So you don't, in this case, you don't really need a huge geometric frustration to get that. Your charge fluctuation can naturally give you that, even on the lattice where geometric frustration is weak. So also for hypergargamel lattice, in this case is interesting because for this lattice structure, even in the larger limit, the model is actually frustrated. But the actual material is supposed to be here near the metal insulator transition. And and according to this idea, the spin liquid insulator is much more stable near metal insulator transition point compared to large U limit. Okay. And one interesting thing about such a scenario is that if you come from metallic state and go into a spin liquid insulator, and in particular, if transition is continuous, then it's generally expected that these spinons may carry fermionic statistics. Indeed, they may also have a Fermi surface of electrons. Because you're starting from metallic state, and if the spin liquid is a fractionalized state, where basically your charge degree of freedom is kept out, but your spin degree of freedom is still intact. So in this sense, once you get rid of all the charge degree of freedom, the remaining spin degree of freedom may also remember the Fermi surface structure of the electron, in case that your spinons are basically fermionic in this ground state. Okay, so those ideas, you can make it a little bit more precise by doing some kind of variation wave function approach. So this is one approach. I mean, this is not the only approach we use, but it's kind of the easiest thing to understand. So this is related to what people call slave particle approach. So what do you do is as follows. You represent your spin operator in terms of slave particle, in this case, fermion. And so, but you have to impose the constraint. The number of fermion per site is exactly one. Okay? In that case, you can show that all the spin commutation relations satisfy usual SU2 algebra. So at this point, it's just a representation. So you have this Heisenberg model. Obviously, if you represent it in terms of fermion, you get a four fermion interaction. And at this stage, I didn't make any improvement, right? Because I just transformed one difficult problem to another difficult problem. Yeah? And this may look even worse because notice that in this Hamiltonian, I only have an interaction. There is no kinetic energy. Yeah, I only have an interaction term. It's an ultimate strong interaction problem. There's no quadratic term. Now, in order to make a progress, you do some kind of mean field theory. So there's a way to make this approximation more rigorous. But at this stage, let me just introduce two kinds of mean field parameters. So those mean field parameters represent, this actually has to be ij. So you may dynamically generate some kind of fermion kinetic energy term, or you may also generate some kind of pairing correlation between fermions. So there are, in general, you can think about two kinds of correlation like this, the particle Hall-like correlation or particle-particle-like correlation. So once you decide that these are the main sort of mean field correlation one can think about, the resulting Hamiltonian can be written like this. So now my quadratic theory can be written in some quadratic theory with a particle pole and particle-particle amplitude. And notice that this Hamiltonian looks exactly like a BCS Hamiltonian. One drawback of such a theory is that because I'm treating these parameters at the mean field level, this exact constraint should be replaced by a mean field constraint. Basically, only the mean field occupation number per site is one. Yeah? So this is much less strict than the original constraint. Okay. The point is that even at this mean field level, we now understand that not every choice of chi and delta are independent. Okay. And they are related by some gauge symmetries and some lattice symmetry transformations. So you have to sort of do an equivalence sort of class kind of analysis. This is what people call projected symmetrical analysis. This is pioneered by Xiaogang Wen, who is coming to PI next fall. So you will be hearing about this the rest of your life. Okay. So okay. So this, you know, this kind of projective symmetry, like it protects what he may call topological order quantum model. So typically when your system is gapped out, this is called topological order. The more general case when excitations are gapless, then it's actually harder to characterize such an order. And this generalized concept of topological order that may be called quantum order. So I'm not going into details, but Xiaogang will tell you about this, right? Anyway, okay. So the point is that this mean field theory construction is not good enough for us, right? Because the constraint is not satisfied exactly. So one way to make a progress is to take those chi and delta parameters as a variational parameter. Variational parameters rather than mean field parameters. Okay? Then you make a wave function ansatz where you basically project out all the unphysical state. You start from a mean field state with chi and delta as a parameter. Then you project out all the unphysical state. So that's what we call Godzilla projection. Then you determine chi and delta that gives a lowest energy solution. It's a variational wave function approach. So what is funny about this business is that if you do the ranking of the ground state for say, you know, many possible competing ground state, for the mean field state and projective state, quite often the ranking changes. Yeah. So what that means is that the lowest energy state at the midfield level may not be the lowest energy state in the projected waveform. So you have to be very careful. It changes quite often. And it just tells you how important the projection is. And the reason why it does that is because energy difference between different candidate states are so small. So it's a very sensitive thing. So this may be a typical approach. Okay. So people talk about gauge theory of spin-Likert phases. And this is sort of inevitable in slave particle construction. So why is that? So imagine that in my BCS-like mean-field Hamiltonian, I only have particle hole-like amplitude, not the particle-particle amplitude. And I'm left with some kind of Hopping term with the chi ij mean-field parameter. And notice that in general, that parameter is a complex number. So I can write it as a magnitude and phase. And you can easily see that if I do a phase transformation on those fermionic variable like that, then I can make a transformation on this phase variable like this. Then the Hamiltonian is invariant, and that's nothing but the usual U1 gauge invariance on the lattice. Okay. So in that sense, there's a degree of freedom related to phase of this field. So that's why those fermionic objects interact with the U1 gauge field. So this is what people call U1 spin-Likert because of that. Yeah? On the other hand, if you have a pairing amplitude, they immediately realize that you don't have this full phase transformation invariance. This Hamiltonian is only invariant on the sign change, plus minus. So only plus minus is a gauge symmetry. Or you may say AI is equal to 0 and pi. Only those variables are allowed. So your gauge field is not so much the phase. It's more like a sign. So it represents Eigen gauge field. So your link field, the variable that live on the link can only have plus or minus. You have a G2 gauge invariance. So those spin-Likert we call G2 spin-Likert. So the mental picture is that if you have a particle-particle amplitude, then generally, typically it's G2. Otherwise, it's U1. You can make a more complicated state, but this is basically a basic idea. Okay. So if you start from a U1 spin-Likert, remember that at the mean field level, it's just a Hopping problem. There's no pairing. So typically, I have some kind of free fermion state. So I have a band structure of free fermion. Then due to projection, that projected state should be the candidate ground state for the U1 spin-Likert. On the other hand, for G2 spin-Likert, the starting ground state wave function looks very much like a BCS ground state, the superconducting state. Then due to the projection, then that projected state is indeed the ground state of G2 spin-Likert. So one way to understand the spin-on, in particular, the G2 spin-Likert is as follows. So imagine, if you have a usual BCS wave function, imagine that I have a system where average number of electrons is 1. Yeah. So it's that the lattice is half here. Yeah? Average number of electrons per side is 1. Okay, but I allow charge fluctuation. I allow charge fluctuation. Yeah, so I can have that. I can have that in a superconductor, right? In superconductor, quasi-particle charge is not concerned. Yeah? So you allow charge fluctuation, but you can always say average number of particle per side is exactly 1. Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Now, in superconductor, the elementary quasi-particles are Bolivar quasi-particles. And Bolivar quasi-particles are superposition of particle state and Hall state. So therefore, if you measure the average charge of the average charge of the Bolivar quasi-particle is 0. But strictly speaking, charge of the quasi-particle is not well defined because charge is not conserved in superconductor. So talking about charge quantum number in superconductor just doesn't make sense. So there's no exact charge, but average charge is 0 because of the construction. Yeah? So in superconductor, you have charge fluctuation. Now imagine that I'm freezing my charge fluctuation gradually in such a way that my Hubbard U becomes infinity so that the number of particles per side is exactly 1, not just average, but strictly 1. Yeah? So particles basically don't move. So in that limit, basically what happens is that your Bolivar quasi-particle superconductor becomes spin-on. Because average charge was 0 for Bolivar quasi-particle. But by the time you freeze out the charge fluctuation, now average charge is charge, right? Charge of that particle. So in that particular limit, you can think of spin-on as a descendant of Bolivar quasi-particle at the half filling. So this is one way to understand spin-on excitations in the G2 spin-Likert. So for the U1 spin liquid.
But if you generate, correct, so if you generate, if you start from a Mott Hubbard system, right?
Yes.
And you generate your Heisenberg interaction, the limit of large U.
Yes.
And you take the limit U goes to infinity.
Yeah.
There will always be some admixture to Dublin's things, right? And so so if you want to have a J, even
yeah.
without rings.
You mean the ring shape, though?
No, even if you don't have ring exchange, yeah. right? If you, there will be, the wave function will contain admixture to the W occupied states, right?
Well, if U is not.
To order one over U squared.
That's right. So the question is whether there's a fixed point state. This is a stable state. With also local perturbation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's basically the question. So if it remains to be stable against those local or the charge fluctuation, basically
some kind of like Dublin correlation would have a more irrelevant eigenvalue.
Yes, exactly. So yeah. so on, in that limit, basically that state becomes the ground state. Yeah. I mean, there should be some. That's what we call topological order. I mean, local perturbation like that wouldn't destroy that state. So the description I gave you is an ideal description of the wave function. So now for U1 spin liquid, you can have gap situations where the skinons are gapped, and your skinons may be gapless. Now in 2D, we understand that gapped spin liquid state in two dimensions simply doesn't exist according to this construction. Because what actually happens is that if your skinons are all gapped out, what is left is just a U1 gauge field. It's a photon. It's a photon. But since we are talking about electrodynamics, so to speak, gauge field on the lattice, those gauge field is compact. So what that means is that you can thread a 2-pi flux through the plug head.
But basically, those processes basically allow physically, you don't change Hamiltonian, for example. Your action or Hamiltonian doesn't change by threading the 2-pi flux. So that kind of process is called, so people call instanton events that makes this state to be unstable. So if you do an experiment, and if you can find a 2D spin liquid with a gap spin on excitation like that, there's something wrong with your experiment, or there's something wrong with our current understanding of the theory. So it's either one way or the other. Yeah. But if those spin on excitations are gapless, then we understand that those states can be stable. In particular, you can have a like Fermi surface of spin-on, or you may have a Dirac point. And depending on the spectrum, you may see different temperature dependence in your heat capacity. Like for Fermi surface, it will be proportional to temperature. For Dirac point, it will be proportional to T squared, et cetera, et cetera. In 3D, this gap state can be stable. We know that. And gapless states can also be stable. But depending on, again, the spectrum of the spin-on, you may get a different power law in heat capacity. So when you are comparing experimental data with those theories, in principle, by looking at the temperature dependence, you should be able to sort of guess what kind of a spin-on spectrum you have in your candidate spin liquid phases. So in an ideal world, yeah, in an ideal world. Okay. Now, one sort of complication is that these are the mean field fixture. And this is what that means is that I'm not including the interaction between those fermionic spinons and the gauge field. If you include those, the situation actually changes. For example, when you have a 2D Fermi surface case, so mean field theory will tell you that this guy has to be proportional to temperature. But in fact, the fluctuation effect tells you that the capacity has to be like T to the 2/3. So more singular. Pardon? Not numerically, but sort of a lot of analytical calculations suggest that this has to be true. So actually, it's a long story. Yeah, long story. Some part we understand, some part we don't understand. If some Sikh is an expert, so he can give you a 1-hour lecture about this thing. And for three-dimensional case, we have a logarithmic correction. If you have a three-dimensional gap case, then these photons will give you heat-cube behavior for spin liquid.
So I can ask a stupid question. So the specific heat in 2D for
yes.
non-interacting fermions, is it T?
Yes.
So the sum of L formula will give you T in 2D.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. So that's basically what this mean free state is.
Right.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, I must have remembered it wrongly.
Okay. Now G2 spin-locate is stable, can be stable in 2D or 3D. It can be gapped, it can be gapless in both ways. It's like a superconductor. So you can have a D-wave gap. In that case, you will have a Dirac point. Or you could have a lino, just like some superconductors. So depending on situation, you get a different spectrum. But there are fully gapped cases. So in that case,
your heat capacity is has an activation, thermally activated behavior. The point is that since this is a G2 spin locate, there are one more interesting excitation in this problem. So this is what people call vison. So these are the defects in the gauge field configuration. So for example, sigma ij is the Eigen gauge field, it's a link field. For example, in the ground state, sigma ij has to choose, like either all sigma ij is plus one, or all sigma ij is minus one. But you can have a defect configuration. Some link may be switched to minus one. Then the product of sigma ij along one of the plot k gives you minus one. So that represents this kind of excitation. And there's an activation gap for such an excitation. That's what we call vison gap. Notice that this vison doesn't carry any quantum number. It doesn't carry charge. It doesn't carry any spin. It only carry entropy. So imagine that I'm doing a measurement of heat capacity and susceptibility. Now, in this phase, I have spin-on, those are gapped. I have vison, those are gapped. I have no photon. Yeah? So there are two kinds of gapped excitations. The point is that only spin-on carries spin quantum number. So now, if I measure heat capacity, since both vison and spin-on carries entropy, I should see two kinds of activation behavior. The first one may be due to vison, thermal activation by vison. Next one may be thermal activation by spin-on. On the other hand, chi, you are not supposed to see this activation at all because vison doesn't carry any spin quantum number. You only see spin-on activation. Yeah. So this naive behavior is actually seen in some version of the XXG model on the Kagome lattice. So this guy, Sergei Isakov, he was my postdoctoral fellow some number of years ago. He did quantum Monte Carlo calculation on XXG model. He found that indeed in the candidate spin liquid G2 spin liquid phase, you indeed see that. This is a highly non-trivial check for spin liquid phase like this. Okay. Then you can have gapless case, just like.
So is it obvious that the vison gap has to be smaller?
No, it's not obvious. It's not always the case. But for this particular material, we actually have an estimation of the vison gap, which is smaller than spin-on gap, from analytical calculation. Remember that these models are not a suitable symmetric model. This is the XXG model. There's only U1 symmetry. I think that's related to that. I don't really understand the deep physics of this, but I think that's part of the reason why, in this particular case, vison gap is smaller than the spin-on gap. Yeah. Right. Okay, so this power law heat capacity is the one signature of spin-liquid material. And if you can determine this power law, in principle, that tells you something about the spectrum of spin-on excitations. Okay. So again, going back to organic material on the triangle lattice, again, the similar idea. The point is that these organic materials are very close to a metal insulator transition. So there's a dynamical sort of frustration. And it turns out that if you do a variational calculation, like what I described to you, then the ground state turns out to be the uniform state, meaning that we have a uniform hopping, no pairing. So you get a U1 spin locate. And in this case, you end up with a Fermi surface of spin-on. So at the mean field level, you should expect that the capacity goes like linear in temperature. In fact, this is what is seen in experiment. Okay? So people got excited about this. But if you do a more sophisticated theory, then it's supposed to be T3 2/3. So there's a trouble here. But then Sentil came to rescue this theory. So he carefully examined the effect of charge fluctuation. It turns out that if you include charge fluctuation near a metal insulator transition, then those charge fluctuations modifies the gauge field fluctuation in such a way that the singularity becomes weaker. So instead of t to two-thirds, you only get logarithmic correction. So t log t. It's a much weaker. Yes. Right. That is also true. Yeah. But if you are there. Yeah.
When do you use the word rescue?
Rescue this strong coupling.
Why do you care? I mean, why does one care that it's two-thirds as opposed to kind of one of the parts?
You want to have an agreement with the experiment. That's a better agreement. So t to, you know, so you see, c by t is t to the minus one-third. So your heat capacity coefficient is supposed to diverge instead of going to constant. In this case, you know, it's only logarithmic. Yeah? So in order to see this log, you have to measure this thing for many decades, which is obviously not done. Yeah? So at least it's a better agreement. Also, in terms of theory, we have a better understanding what actually happens in your metallurgical transition. This power law indeed changes. So this is true if the charge gap is infinity. That was the underlying assumption. Now, if charge gap is small, this is what you get. If temperature is bigger than, say, typical charge gap. And assumption is the charge gap is small in the metallurgical transition.
But is it easy to distinguish two-thirds from one, you know, if you have a small temperature range?
No, it's not easy. Like, yeah. So these are all good questions. And so, you know, basically we need more data. So, you know, just to show you, this is the heat capacity data, C by T, for this organic material. You see that there's a finite gamma. So this may actually tell you, that you have a Fermi surface, but there is this subtle issue as to what the correct or the actual temperature dependence of the capacity should be according to theory. So another thing is that for this organic material, even though from heat capacity you expect that heat capacity coefficient gamma is constant, what that tells me is that I have a Fermi surface. If I have a Fermi surface, then your thermal conductivity kappa by T has to be constant at low temperature, just like a metal. Remember that spinons carry entropy, so it contributes to the heat current. Yeah, it carries energy and entropy. So kappa by T has to be constant at low temperature. In this case, it looks like it doesn't. Actually, kappa by T looks like it's going to zero. This is a paper published in Nature Physics. So it looks like there is a gap, some kind of gap. Okay. So then, of course, lots of theories came into this story. Right? So one possible scenario is that perhaps at very low temperature, you develop this pairing amplitude between spinon. So that this U1 spin liquid at high temperature basically becomes G2 spin. So there are various ways of doing this. As usual, there's more than one scenario for that. But the general idea is that, you know, pairing amplitude may develop some kind of pairing transition. So the lower temperature phase may be a G2 spin liquid rather than a U1 spin liquid. And in fact,
Why would it not be seen in variational calculation?
Variational calculation?
I mean the basic modulation calculation. Why would the spanning not be?
Right. But so the point is as follows. So these materials are not actually sitting on an ideal triangular lattice. And so this TNT prime are actually slightly different. In fact, the ground state of this material is extremely sensitive to this ratio. So if you change this ratio slightly, you get a different ground state. For example, you know, in a similar series of material, by changing this ratio, you can even get into an antiferromagnetic state. So there's some subtle issues as to, you know, the effect of TNT prime. At the same time, remember that this material vehicles metallurgical transition. So you have to think about an effective spin model on an unisotropic triangle lattice. It's not very carefully examined. Right. But then there is a different organic material. This is actually a better candidate in the sense that these guys show constant, you know, constant gamma or linear temperature heat capacity. But kappa by T is actually damn linear. I mean, kappa by T approaches constant. So this material so far seems to be a much better candidate for U1 spin liquid with the Fermi surface. So it remains to be true until today.
What does the NMR line shape look like again on this material? So
there is an NMR measurement, but unfortunately, this NMR relaxation, it doesn't fit to the usual.
I'm asking about the line shape.
I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember. So I'm just showing you that in two materials show constant gamma, so nothing else. There. Okay. What about Kagome-Lattice? This is a complicated issue. If you do a variational calculation, it turns out that ground state is actually U1 Dirac spin locus. So you have a U1 spin locus, you have a photon, but the spectrum is Dirac Fermion in two dimensions. In this case, the capacity has to be T square, susceptibility has to be linear in temperature. This is not what is seen in the experiment. At least in the previous experiment. So, you know, to explain experimental data, you sort of have to include things like disorder and all that. Yeah. Now, this, if you only think about a Heisenberg model on the Kagome-Lattice, then there are some, you know, numerical results on this system. So, for example, there are two possible candidates for the possible ground state. One of them is this famous valence bond state with the 36 unit cell, is shown here. A lot of people worked on here. Actually, I think Giffre worked on this using his MIRA method and all that. So if this is the case, then you have a capacity that's thermally activated, but delta is, can be quite small. So even if this may be true, but then it'll be very difficult to tell the difference between power law and this guy, real experiment. Recent DMRG calculation may tell you that, you know, the ground state is a spin liquid, the finite spin gap. In this case, the possible candidate is a G2 spin liquid in this case. Yeah, because it's a two dimension. There's a finite spin gap. I told you the U1 spin liquid is not possible. So the only other possibility is a G2 spin liquid. So that, I don't think there's a direct proof for that at the moment, but that will be a guess. From our analytical understanding. Yeah. So, one point I'd like to make is that perhaps one of these two states is a ground state of the pure Heisenberg model. But remember, in real experimental system, Heisenberg model, SU2 symmetric Heisenberg model may not be the Hamiltonian for this material. So what that tells you is that when you're thinking about phenomenology of this thing, you want to think about many, you know, sort of degenerate, you know, almost degenerate ground state. So what, you know, just by tipping the balance a little bit, you may get a different state. So what you really want to study is the bunch of competing states. One of them may be really realized in real experiment. So not just those two. Yeah. Okay, I'll skip this. So there's a three-dimensional version of this. I told you that. So again, if you measure the heat capacity, look at the blue curve of this hyper-Kagome-Lattice lattice, the C by T is again constant, and the susceptibility, yeah. So I'm gonna skip that, it's complicated physics. But so again, the point is that if you do a variational calculation, variational wave function, then you discover that ground state is actually a U1 spin liquid with a Fermi surface. But in this case, there's a small electron pocket and hole pocket, okay, yeah. So at the mean field level, again, you may expect that heat capacity is linear in temperature, yeah? But if you do a more controlled calculation, then you find that actually there has to be a logarithmic correction in the case that charge gap is infinity. But again, this material is very close to metal insulator transition, so you have to, again, take into account this charge fluctuation. So once you do that, this log singularity is even becomes like log singularity. And this is log is almost absent. It's basically one. That's my claim, right? And experiment, C of T is basically almost T. So perhaps the point is in 3D, the singularity is actually weaker. So in a way, once you can stabilize the spin in three dimension, you know, maybe this is in contrast to usual intuition that in three dimension, you get a better magnetic ordering. But in fact, this guy behaves more like a mean field spin liquid state in three dimension. The fluctuation is actually smaller, not stronger. Okay, so I'll skip that. So in the remaining like 5 minutes or so, I'm going to spend a little time on this new proposal on a topological Mali insulator. So this popular view these days that there are two kinds of topological phases, right? So for example, there's type one phase, where usually when you talk about a topological phases, basically we are saying that there's no adiabatic path between some simple trivial phases to topological phases by doing some local unitary transformation. And say simple phases are say phases where we can characterize this phase by some local order parameters or information. So examples of this generic sort of topological phases are like a quantum Hall state and spin-Likert. The spin-Likert phase I described to you is this type, basically. On the other hand, there's a slightly different class of topological phases. So it's called symmetric protected phases. So basically what happens is that these topological phases and these simple phases may have certain local symmetries. And if your path does not break the symmetry, then you cannot connect these two phases adiabatically. But if you're willing to break the symmetry, then you can construct a path by a local transformation without closing the bulk gap. So the example is, famous example is topological band insulator. So topological band insulator is protected by time inversal symmetry. So imagine that these two phases are time inversal symmetric. If you try to construct a path between them, and if the path has to satisfy time inversal symmetry, then you cannot connect them. Okay, but if you're willing to break time inversal symmetry along the way, then you can connect these two phases. Yeah. So these phases are not as generic as the previous one. So because this one, you know, in principle, I can connect the path. It's just that I have to break that local symmetry. So in that sense, these topological phases are. So not the local symmetry, discrete symmetry, sorry. So in that sense, these symmetries, you know, these phases are protected by this kind of discrete symmetry, like time inversal symmetry. So the question is, can you have both? Can you have, type one and type two properties at the same time? Yeah. So one possibility is I have a spin Likert. Let's think about a three-dimensional spin Likert, where the spinons actually have topological band structure. So I told you that if spinons are gapped in two dimensions, such a phase is unstable. In three dimensions, they can be stable. So spinons are in a band insulator. So all the spinons are gapped out. So in 2D, such a state is unstable. But in 3D, it's possible. So let's think about that. But then spinons have certain spectrum. Yeah. So this spectrum, you know, may be topological in the sense that the electrons in topological band insulator, topological spectrum. So if you can have such a phase, okay. So in this case, spinons are gapped, but they are still interacting with the U1 gauge field. So U1 gauge field still lives in the bulk, three-dimensional space. So this will be your effective theory. And this is a fractionalized topological insulator in the sense that it's a topological insulator, but topological insulator of fractionalized degree of freedom, namely the spin-on, and it's protected by time inversal symmetry. So it has both properties, you know, basically spin-Likert, so it's a type one topological order, and topological band structure is type two topological order. So notice that if I break time inversal symmetry, then I get rid of type two property, but type one property is intact. So it's doubly topological. So this is what I call topological spin Likert. Yeah. So Subro, he's here in the audience, also Sung Sik and I, and also Dong Hai Lee at Berkeley. We decided to construct a spin model that may be a good candidate for such a phase. So here is the model. So I have a J1, J2 model on the parallel lattice. The trick is that the J2. The next nearest neighbor coupling has to be ferromagnetic. In this case, if you use the usual slave particle representation and do the mean field decoupling, then you end up with this kind of mean field Hamiltonian. So the one interesting thing is that if you do so, then one of the mean field parameters, here E, is actually acts like a spin-orbit coupling. So this is actually emergent spin-orbit coupling. So even though the original Hamiltonian was SU2 symmetric, the resulting mean field Hamiltonian is not. It breaks SU2.
So the
but
E is dynamical here?
It's a dynamical field. Well, it's the mean field parameters. It's fixed in the ground state. In the ground state is fixed. So ground state basically breaks this SU2 symmetry. But nonetheless, this phase is not magnetically altered. It's a spin liquid. So mean field theory tells you that we get a spin liquid with a strong topological insulator in the sense that you can work out the band structure of this model. Then you can show the using you know, usual criterion of topological insulator of electron, you can show that this belongs to this one of those strong topological insulator. The spectrum is topological. Okay. So one interesting thing is that some symmetry is obviously broken, right? Because I broke SU2 symmetry to something. Yeah? So this broken symmetry is basically what you call bond span numeric order. So the expectation value of S is zero. There's no magnetic ordering. In that sense, it's spin liquid. But you have some kind of broken symmetry that is this bond spin numeric order. So it turns out that this is kind of you can think of this as a scale of the spin operator. So even though expectation value of spin is zero, expectation value of S square is non-zero. So this is you know, one of the examples of multipolar order, in this case, a spin numeric order. So you have a spin numeric order, but there's no magnetic ordering. The elementary excitations are spin-on, and they have a topological spectrum. So there are two. You can have two kinds of excitations in the bulk. You can have photons. The U1 gauge will still floating around, and then yeah, there may be a Goldstone mode due to broken spin numeric order, broken spin rotation.
Would you still call it spin liquid?
Pardon?
Would you still call this phase as spin liquid?
Yeah. So in the sense that it doesn't break translation symmetry. So this doesn't break
translation. There's a local order parameter.
That's right. So it's a coexistence. So there's a topological order. It has everything. So it has a type 1 topological order, it has type 2 topological order, and there's a broken symmetry. All three at the same time.
In your definition of what is a spin liquid,
yes.
That doesn't contradict that definition.
No, when I said, I carefully said spin liquid is just doesn't break translation symmetry. So this one breaks rotation symmetry, may break rotation, spin rotation symmetry, but it doesn't break translation symmetry.
Okay.
So in that sense, it's a spin liquid. So it's a liquid means you don't break translation symmetry. That's my definition of liquid. So you may say this is not a pristine spin liquid because you have some broken symmetry, but it's morally spin liquid. I would say.
Okay.
Belongs the same class. It's a fractionalized spin-on. Yeah. And then you have a U1 photon. Yeah. It has every characteristics of spin liquid. Okay, so in analogy to usual electronic topological insulator, remember that in usual strong topological insulator, even the bulk is gapped, surface is gapless, and gapless excitation at the surface of topological insulator is a Dirac fermion. So similarly, the surface of such a topological square spin liquid is that you at the boundary you can have a gapless Dirac spin-on. Okay. Now, these guys carry entropy and it heat. So what that means is that even the bulk may be a thermal insulator. At the surface, you may conduct heat. You may get a thermal conduction at the surface. Now, these are insulators. So both bulk and surface are charged insulators. So charged, there's no charge transport whatsoever everywhere. On the other hand, you can have a thermal conduction only at the surface, not in the bulk. So that will be one characteristic of such a phase. So I'm not going to talk about defect. So time is almost up. So I'm going to summarize. So you can sort of think about lots of interesting ideas around this. So I have to say our theory of spin liquid is incomplete in many ways. You know, these theories are not really controlled. So we need some kind of standard model. Yeah. So we don't have that. Yeah. So string theory people call their theory M theory. And they don't know what M theory is, but they can still set it. So I decided maybe we should call this guy as S theory. We don't know what S theory is. We can still sell them, right? So, there's some interesting theory that we don't know about completely. We know some glimpse of it, but not everything. Now, in the usual metallic state, the standard model is Landau form liquid theory, where basically your central interaction is a density-density interaction between particles, so electrons. Then instability of electron forming surface gives you all kinds of broken symmetry state, like charge density wave, spin density wave, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if I think about a spin-on, especially spin-on forming surface state, you know, spin-liquid state, and notice that spin-on-spin-on interaction is actually not density-density interaction. It's mainly current-current interaction. Why is that? Because it's a gauge field interaction. Spin-on-spin-on interacting in terms of gauge field, exchanging gauge field. That's nothing but the current-current interaction. It's not a density-density interaction. And usually, we don't talk about this current-current interaction in the condensed matter system because, you know, current-current interaction is a relativistic effect. So it's, you know, it's down by, say, fine structure constant compared to density-density interaction. It's negligible. We don't talk about this. But here, speed of light for photon is basically 1. So it suddenly becomes extremely important. So now imagine that I have a current-current interaction on top of this Fermi surface state. Now I can ask myself, what may be the instability of such a spin-on Fermi surface? The nature of the instability may not be the same, because I'm now talking about current-current interaction, not the density-density interaction. We never really studied this so carefully, because it was not important at all in usual condensed matter system. So perhaps if I use this, maybe I can get a variety of Mach insulators. So I can perhaps start from here. I can, you know, generate all sorts of broken symmetry state and et cetera, et cetera. Perhaps I can use that as my standard model. But the spin-ons don't really have to be well defined. What really is important is the gauge invariant object, or gauge invariant response functions. So that's another way to think about this problem, that perhaps thinking about spin-on may not be the essential thing. Yeah? Spin-ons are just convenient description of the phase. You know? Because the spin-ons are strongly interacting with each other. So, you know, in a way, single particle like spin-ons quite often don't really exist, right? So perhaps these are not the right variable. Yeah? So another thing to think about, like, you know, whether gauge theory is really necessary. So we insist on gauge theory because we insist that my particles have to be either bosons or fermions, right? So then the only way to represent long range current-current interaction is to use the gauge field. I start from a fermion and boson, but then fundamental interaction is current-current, long range current-current interaction. It's not screened. The reason why Landau Fermi liquid theory is so effective is that the density-density interaction in ordinary metal gets screened, eventually becomes short-ranged. That's why we can sort of talk about a single particle picture. But here, current-current interaction is not screened. It's always a long-range interaction. It never screened. So it's fundamentally a long-range interaction compared to density-density interaction. But if you insist that particle have the fermions, bosons, then, you know, there's really not many ways to describe it. One way to do that is to use the gauge field, and that's why all the time we end up talking about gauge theory. But perhaps there's a better way of doing that. I don't know. And we need more experiment, basically, to determine those predictions. Okay, I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Have a spin liquid where spin-ons are wild
pronouns? I guess you can have the, I think you can arrange that, yes? But I don't have a model. Yeah. I don't have a model. Yeah. It's not like I can put out
fundamental
wild fermion spin-ons like that. So, anyway,
are there any fundamental principles that would prohibit that?
I don't see any fundamental principle that will prohibit that. Yeah. Because the Weyl spectrum is the property of band structure, and it's, you know, it's
is basically also bifurcation state also protected by some symmetry. So if there's a way to impose the symmetry there, I'm pretty sure you can come up with a spectrum like that. So it may not be easy to get a bifurcation state where the chemical potential is exactly at the bipolar, but I'm pretty sure that you can get a state with the spectrum, but you know, it's chemical potential slightly away from that. I think that's probably reasonably easy to get.
So is it possible that maybe in presence of disorder, you can have a gapless spin liquid that has exponentially decaying correlation function?
Yeah, but then you have to take into account the local excitations, right? Mm-hmm. So you're saying if you have a disorder, but in which situation you want to have a disorder? Like because it is possible that because of the impurities, you can generate a sort of a power law correlation in time. Yeah, which seems some local fluctuation. Mostly temporal. If you have sort of additional temporal fluctuations, maybe there is a way to generate.
So on the contrary, I'm asking if you can. So instead of adding the power law, instead of that, you might have just exponentially decaying correlation functions, like in a gap situation.
I think usually it's the other way around, right? Usually when you have an impurities, you have more low energy excitations. So more low energy excitation means, so imagine that in a clean system there is a gap, but you could generate some local excitation.
No, I know. So in fact, I'm thinking more something like a mobility gap.
Okay.
So the system is gapless, but the spinons get localized.
You want to localize some of the spinon. Okay, yeah, this is possible. Yeah. In principle, you can. But again, that kind of localization problem is slightly different from electron localization.
Right.
Mainly because of this gauge field. So I mean, in the past, we studied some of this localization problem with the gauge field.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, it's not exactly the same.
Yeah, I imagine. So can you elaborate a little bit? Because it must be richer.
Yeah, so for example, it's not as universal as the usual. So even if you do a weak localization kind of calculation, weak localization calculation tells you that there's a logarithmic correction to conductivity, which is universal. Yeah, which is universal. I mean, in the sense that you get a log correction, log of temperature, but coefficient, just log of t. But what you get is different. You have some. I figured you have that this double logarithm. One of the logarithm was not universal. It's more complicated. So I can, feel like I can point to some reference.
Yeah.
It's a complicated issue. I don't think we understand. Yeah.
So could you go back to a slide before? We were talking about the general, we were talking about a new possible approach, possible new way of thinking about it. Just go back to the...
So
then you say broken symmetry states.
Yeah.
So which kind of symmetry would be the relevant symmetry to be broken?
So this part of the question. So in the case of density-density interaction, we talk about instability of electron Fermi surface. Typically, we talk about things like a charge density wave state or spin density wave state. It's a modulation of charge density or modulation of spin density. That's usually the state you get, typically. Now, once you have a current-current interaction, then you can think about some instability to some current patterns.
Current patterns.
So current is modulated instead of, say, density is modulated. And, for example, one interesting example is if the spin-on current is modulated, then I think what actually happens is that corresponds to modulation of some kind of spin chirality. So if you have three sites, nearby site, you can form a triple product of spin S1 dot S2 cross S3. So one can show that actually corresponds to spin current.
So what are you breaking? What are you breaking there? Reflection symmetry, parity, or what symmetry is being broken? so in that kind of situation.
Right, so is it S dot S cross S? So in that case, you are breaking a tiny bosel, for example. Yeah, you could break tiny bosel symmetry. So I'm just giving you an example that may not arise naturally in the usual formulaic theory. So there could be a more variety of broken symmetry state we didn't think about in the usual metallic state. That's part of the question. Can you think about a sort of more exotic broken symmetry state starting from this ground state? Notice that this ground state is basically paramagnetic ground state. There's no broken symmetry.
More questions? Okay, so that's fine. I'm back again.